You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, April 10th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, but no, it isn't. I'm actually recording this on a Thursday because I'm on vacation right now, my last blessed day of vacation. My God, when will I get away from my children? I mean, I love them. Don't get me wrong, in the event that one of them is listening to this by some happenstance. But come on. Aren't you guys sick of me too? I know you are. Folks, we got a great show for you today. Professor of History from Princeton University, Keith Whalew. Author of Pain, A Political History, will join me to discuss pain and its political history. I know, it sounds weird, doesn't it? But it's fascinating stuff, I think. I think you will too. Then, for members from the deep, deep archive, Janine Garofalo and I on the old Majority Report, welcome into studio Colin Quinn, sort of our frenemy at the time. I'd known Colin for quite a while at that time, even, and his politics went a little askew for a while. I think you'll see that reflected in this interview. It's almost a fight. In fact, I have pictures of us, like, almost getting into fake fisticuffs. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Folks, reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, featuring free shipping all this month, only this month. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. It will be cheaper to buy a pound of coffee from them than anywhere else you buy, you know, good coffee. And this is fair trade. This is co-op owned. And 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. Win, 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 win. I would get to it. All right, folks, we'll be back live on Monday. Have a great weekend. Enjoy today's show.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a farm.
We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Steeder on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the Townsend Martin Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, also the Vice Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, Keith Whalew. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And, of course, your book is Pain, A Political History, and I have to say it is – it's fascinating. I never contemplated and the thing is, I talk about all these issues almost on a daily basis, and had never really sort of contemplated how the perception of pain and the idea of pain plays into our politics. And in some ways, I mean, you argue that that pain or the attitudes, the cultural attitudes that we have in our society about pain are sort of a leading indicator for where we will end up as a society on our social welfare programs. Let's start with you start tracking this stuff following World War II. Talk to us about what that era was in terms of our perception of pain.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I have to tell you that even before I started this project, I wasn't quite aware, as I am now, as to the level of politicization over this question of who's in pain and what level of relief they deserve. So after World War II, you have thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers returning from the war, many of them losing limbs, scarred, in pain. And one of the core questions that confronts the Veterans Administration and society at large is how to take care of these people. And, you know, we know certain physical disabilities warrant disability benefits and long-term care. But one of the questions that was asked at the time in the 50s is pain, chronic pain associated with injuries, itself a compensable disability? And what should we expect? And it, surprisingly, physicians were, to call it ambivalent is to overstate it, they were by and large deeply skeptical that chronic pain was something that was more than just psychological and psychosomatic, evidence of some kind of psychiatric maladjustment. So the question about whether pain is real or not, whether it's something that is medical, whether it deserve people in pain deserve relief, ended up becoming not just a question about medical judgment, but they were also aware of the fact that, you know, for that many of them, the idea of pain being long-term was a question about liberalism. It was a question about government relief. It was a question about whether you were creating dependence, long-term dependence, by validating pain as real. And it turns out that that debate, which is at once medical, was also a reflection of the political moment in which you have people like Harry Truman arguing for national health insurance. You have the American Medical Association deeply skeptical about socialized medicine. And pain becomes, you might say, a football. The question of whether people in pain are faking, whether they're truly in pain, whether they're psychologically and psychiatrically maladjusted, or whether they're people who deserve relief from a compassionate society because of injuries sustained in the name of defending the country, ends up becoming a fracture point for doctors, for people in government, for politicians, and ultimately for people in the law, because these issues migrate into the legal setting. So that's where my story begins. And what I end up doing is tracking the fact that, you know, pain, sadly, never, people in pain never become entirely disengaged from these fraught political debates in American society over liberalism, conservatism, the role of government in our lives. And, you know, in some ways, what started off for me as a medical story became a political story.
And I got to say, I mean, I know that as people hear you count these things, I know that in their minds, they're going through some of the issues that they hadn't contemplated really have to do with pain and how they become political footballs. Social Security disability is in the news. We're pre-recording this interview. And today I spoke to a journalist who had done a story about OxyContin sales in Florida, and these exact questions came up. And so before, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but I want to stay, you know, so at that era, it seems to me there were two things that are working on the perception of pain, or two biggest factors, I think, in terms of how it commingles with public policy. One is that for doctors who are becoming a political force at that time, right? Because they're concerned about what are the implications of, you know, as we see with Britain, you're getting the NIH, and they're concerned about what role they're going to have in our in the way that they get paid, frankly. Pain is one of those things that they don't necessarily – a chronic pain is almost definitionally something that they can't fix. And so it sort of undercuts their authority. Simultaneously, you have this notion of we don't want – you know, it's one thing to have an injury to a vet who's coming back, but at least, you know, on some level, again, that's sort of addressable in that moment. The idea of chronic pain is like an open wound that comes from the war and also sort of belies the sense of, you know, this is the greatest generation. How could they exhibit this so-called weakness by continuing to suffer on some level? Both those things commingle at this time, right?
You're totally right. So, you know, in medicine at this time, and increasingly, there's a commitment to problems being solvable. They're more comfortable with acute problems, right? You know, you come in, you have a problem, you're treated, you leave. Chronic pain does not lend itself. It's a source of frustration for professionals. It actually highlights what they don't know and what they can't really treat. And as a result, it becomes a question for them as to whether it belongs in their purview at all. But here's the interesting thing that happens. In the Eisenhower administration, these are political questions. And one of the things that a very, very crafty Senate majority leader named Lyndon Baines Johnson does in the 1956 election year is he manages to force a discussion, a public vote on the question of whether disability benefits ought to be in part of the Social Security provisions. So not just a provision for the elderly, but also for the disabled. And he manages to get this onto Eisenhower's desk in an election year where Eisenhower is compelled, despite the fact that the American Medical Association and physicians are deeply skeptical about this category of disability. And Eisenhower reluctantly signs this legislation, which establishes and creates the groundwork for the very debate that you're describing, the debate about can doctors even judge the category of disability, let alone pain as a disability. So you might say that, you know, despite physicians' reluctance, the creation of a disability benefit almost makes them gatekeepers. It forces them to have opinions on this matter. And it's and their opinions have huge stakes into as to who is going to be allowed benefits and who is not going to be allowed benefits. So you're right that there are a number of different frustrations here about both government and about the role of physicians to even judge this matter. Let me just say one other thing that kind of prefigures the OxyContin era as well. You might say in the 50s, there are two simultaneous problems having to do with pain. One is the problem of public relief, that is, creation of disability systems and whether people in pain belong there or not. The other is the private relief system. So the post-war era also leads to a boom in drugs, a boom in tranquilizers, new pain medicines. And, you know, physicians, interestingly enough, are just as ambivalent about the downsides. Just like there's the question of government dependence, there's also a question of drug dependence. That is to say, Percodan, new painkillers, they promise relief without habit forming, but increasingly it becomes clear that there are downsides to that kind of aggressive pharmaceutical relief as well. So the post-war era really kind of introduces Americans, doctors, politicians, people in pain to the political story that I subsequently tell.
And so from there, and the interesting thing too is that, you know, and I think you do the, like I say, you argue that the pain is almost sort of a leading indicator of where the social welfare programs will go, but then it's almost like it doubles back around and becomes a, you know, sort of weaponized in the sort of a backlash to that. And I don't want to get, again, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because we're seeing, you know, the Social Security disability is sort of the
low-hanging pinata for conservatives at the moment. And like you say, because it's something that is so hard to measure, it becomes sort of a fertile ground to build up a notion that there's a lot of fraud going on.
That's right.
And so, all right, but let's, so we come out of that era where Eisenhower is sort of boxed in and he, and we've got the Social Security disability, and it's almost like there's like, I guess, three eras of the way that we look at pain following the post-World War II era. This is one of them, right, where there's sort of a somewhat of a reluctance to of accept it. How does it mutate into the next?
Yeah, so you're right. There's a kind of a reluctance, but it inevitably, once you establish this disability provision and you realize that pain is real and to some extent warrants compassionate relief, the next stage is both a political one, it's a scientific one, and it's a legal one. I'd say one of the key figures, I'd say there may be three key figures, but one of them is unquestionably a Eisenhower appointee to the federal courts named John Brown, who in 1963 makes a ruling. And the ruling hinges on the question of whether a Texas housewife named Rosie Page, who has pain as the source of her disability, she's appealed to the Social Security Administration for benefits. She's been rejected. And John Brown has to decide whether that rejection should stand or not because she's appealed in the federal courts. And he makes a ruling that really becomes a real precedent. He says if pain is real to the patient, that is, you know, pain involves a certain amount of intersubjective understanding, compassion. You know, I can't know how much pain you're in, right? I might be able to judge by your facial features or other indices, your blood pressure, et cetera, but ultimately I don't know. So the question of trust is key. And he essentially says people in pain deserve a level of compassion and understanding and trust. And he really opens the door to the idea that pain is a disability that warrants this kind of relief. Well, one of the things that happens in the course of the 1963, at the same time you have scientists saying, you know, pain is more than just neurophysiology. It's also subjective experience. Pain is a really complicated phenomenon, and we need to think about it in terms of psychology, et cetera. So you have, and the pain field is actually emerging in the 1960s as well, partly because this issue has been thrust upon them. The question of having to measure who's in pain, who's not. And through the 1960s, not only does the field grow, the theories about pain expand, and the challenge of, you know, these government programs that have grown to accommodate people in pain in an increasingly liberal era. It's the Great Society. So it might be a reach to say that the passage of Medicare 50 years ago and Medicaid is part of the story, but arthritis pain for the elderly is a real, it's a new phenomenon that's widely written about that helps to undergird the argument that we need these kinds of new programs to take care of people who are suffering, who do have long-term pain, for whom this is one of the few ways in which we can provide relief as a society. So you cannot separate the history of pain in the 1960s from the commitments and the political culture of the Great Society and a liberal era. But as you say, it then turns because
I don't mean to interrupt, but what was going on? I mean, how did we get into, I mean, it seems like following World War II, right, that the evolution begins, but why does it begin then as opposed to say, I don't know, after World War I? Or, right. I mean, is it, or let me just ask, is it, you know, when Social Security, when we come out of the Depression and we pass this the New Deal, and the sort of the undergirding implications is that, like, society has a wider, and government has a role in stuff that happens to individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not just, there's a reason why society exists, and it is because we have a responsibility to deal with the individual you know, bad luck, or, you know, part of Social Security is if you're an orphan. And is that what sort of like also became the impetus of a new way of perceiving pain? Or was it, because I presume, like, you know, we had the same problem with vets coming back from World War One, right? Or
yes, so you're right. You have to have you're right. The difference between vets coming home from World War One and World War Two is as you say, the New Deal, the role of government in managing the economy and managing people's lives, but also World War Two. You know, what emerges from that is things like the GI Bill, things like government making sure that the reintegration of soldiers is done in a way that serves their interests and the interests of society. So you're right that after World War II, there's a greater role, presumed role for government in managing reintegration of the population, the health of the population. But there's something else going on after World War II that's really important, which is what people in my field often call the great epidemiological transition. That is to say, we have a society by 1940 where the leading causes of death are not the same as about 40 years earlier. People died, the leading cause of death in 1900 was tuberculosis, infectious disease. Those have declined systematically over the course of the first half of the 20th century. And what begins to emerge as the leading causes of death are the things we think of as chronic, degenerative, the kinds of things that we think about today, cancer, heart disease. So you might say it's a society that's also changing in which pain, live longer, you're more likely to have arthritis, right? So the problem of the elderly isn't just like a new sensitivity. It's also a demographic phenomenon where you have actually older people that are larger in numbers. So people sort of think, you know, Medicare just came along. Medicare came along because, you know, you have a larger percentage of the population that's elderly living longer and actually don't have the means to take care of themselves. They were a significant percentage of the poor. It made complete sense to kind of, you know, create these kinds of programs. And you might say pain, the idea that chronic pain is real, is also part of this transformation.
That's
so you're right. Part of it is after World War II, but part of it is also understanding the profile of health in America at that time.
Let me ask you one more part before we go back to the 60s and 70s. The notion – And I wonder, you know, again, I guess it's sort of hard to say, you know, what comes first, and maybe they come at the same time. But this notion, we also, following World War II, adopt a different role in the world, right? On some level, we're the healers. The Marshall Plan is all about us coming in and fixing these societies and healing them. And on some level, it's hard to justify doing that for other people if you're not doing it for your own people.
That's right, yeah. Although in the case of pain, there's another logic, which is Truman always worried about the fact that if we were going to build so many kind of social welfare programs for the veterans, like a VA system, for instance, and this is what the AMA was concerned about as well, shouldn't we also be taking care of the general population? Are we just sort of carving out services only for vets? Or should we be thinking about the larger society? And in this sense, I'd say that Americans were really kind of followers, you know, deeply skeptical about the growth of government. So whereas the British are going full hog towards a national health system, we are still kind of debating whether the VA system should exist in the first place or to what extent it can be built upon. So in this sense, I think I wouldn't say that Americans – I'm not sure how much what you just described was a key to the story, but it may be.
Interesting. All right. So we're in the 60s and the 70s, and it's sort of the perception of pain is changing, and it's also impacting – I mean, I guess it's – you know, we're away from that part of – if you feel pain, you are necessarily weak, or even, I guess it's also, even if it's a dynamic, if pain is a dynamic, that still doesn't make it illegitimate.
That's right, yeah. So one of the things that happens in the 70s, for instance, is, you know, things pushing the boundaries of pain, like, you know, when Richard Nixon goes to China, James Reston, the New York Times columnist, has an appendix attack and ends up being treated post operatively with acupuncture. And so there's even more interest in other ways of dealing with pain. This is the rise of kind of alternative or complementary medicine. You know, so by the 1970s, but there's a lot of talk about pain, not just in medicine, but elsewhere. But what happens is with the growth of a large Social Security disability system, with the rise of health and welfare services more generally, post-Medicare, I mean, already in the early 1970s, people are talking about the spiraling costs of Medicare and Medicaid as programs. Conservatives of the Ronald Reagan variety, anyway, begin to worry, as they do, and campaign against the growth of government. You know, government is not the solution to your problem. Government is the problem, right? Ronald Reagan famously said, right, in these times. And within 2 months of assuming office in 1981, in January, Reagan and his Secretary for Health and Human Services, Schweiker, begin a process, or actually they continue a process that Carter had already begun, of looking very closely at people on the Social Security disability rolls, many of whom are claiming what they call as subjective reasons for their disability. And to systematically remove, it would be up to 500,000 over the course of the next 3 years from the disability rolls. And a significant percentage of them were people claiming pain. And from the conservative perspective, these really weren't people in pain. These were examples of pain fraud. These are people who are claiming to be in pain, but really just out to get something for nothing. They're examples of the problem of big government. You know, if you build it, they will come. You're creating dependency. They're being pulled out of the workforce. So you can see how the people in pain become, and disabled in general, become a political football, not for liberals interested in compassion and government and the role of government to relieve, but for conservatives who are trying to highlight the inefficiencies and the problems of this. My story by chapter three turns to what I called the conservative case against learned helplessness, which is a new theory that emerges out of pain. Some pain scholars who argue that, you know, if you take too much good care, if you take too good care of people in chronic pain, they become bedridden, they become dependent. So even if the pain is real, you're not doing anything good for them. And this is a viewpoint that still is important today.
That dynamic seems to me to be the number one animating policy response by conservatives today. I mean, because its cousin at the time, right, Reagan, is the welfare queen, who's
That's
actually
exactly
just
right.
gaming the system. And mm-hmm. now, you know, Paul Ryan gets up there and tells a story about the kid who doesn't want to get the free lunch from school. They'd rather in a paper bag and it cooked from home, and it does something to his dignity to get lunch. And that seems to be we're still in that era.
Well, this is where that script, you might say, is being written. Although what's really interesting, you know, Ronald Reagan worked with the against Medicare back in the early 60s. And, you know, what's interesting to me is to see how the rhetoric that you're describing from Paul Ryan was really crafted very, very early on. And there's a kind of shocking convergence between how physicians, who were really central in the rise of the conservative response to liberal government, how their views about the illegitimacy of people in pain, or at least the illegitimacy of pain, and the dangers of coddling, the dangers of being too compassionate, really are part of, you might say, the Reagan mindset, even from an early day. And you might say it's still part of the conservative skepticism.
You don't want the safety net to become a hammock. It's the
exactly.
same dynamic.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting for me is how, you know, the conservative vision of transforming Social Security was limited by the fact that we have a court system. And many of the people who were thrown off the Social Security disability rolls took their case to court. And ultimately, a lot of these questions, who's in pain, how do you know, what degree of relief they deserve, how do you measure it, were decided by judges. And so the fascinating thing for me, once again, is to, on the one hand, you might say, the debate about whether to take care of a patient in a hospital, you might think of as just a clinical question having to do with compassionate care, what I learned is that it's a kind of a microcosm and in some ways connected to the political debate about dependence, welfare, or compassion, on the other hand. And sometimes the lines between the politics of pain outside and the politics of pain care are just, there's no boundary. But what's interesting is the degree to which the courts are the ones where some of these issues are adjudicated, especially when the politics becomes fraught. And so what I do in the book is to show how ultimately the people who have to judge these questions are not the doctors and the scientists, and often not the politicians, liberal or conservative or libertarian or whatever. They're often judges, ironically judges who have no, you know, they might have a strong ideological position on this, but they don't really have the kind of expertise that physicians do. So the book really, and during Reagan's administration, another funny thing happens that also is still with us today, which is the rise of the religious right kind of identifies another kind of pain, fetal pain.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get to this because it seems to me like with fetal pain and OxyContin, it's almost like the political efficacy of how pain is used is then like taken out of that narrative and then reapplied in a different way.
That's right.
So, yeah, talk about the how fetal pain, I mean, I think people are aware of it, but we hear all these sort of personhood amendments, which are cropping up in states across the country as a way of cutting into a woman's right to choose an abortion. And fetal pain is the central sort of, engine behind that.
That's right. So the way I would put it is this, you know, you might ask yourself, where does this argument come from? And it comes from a time when conservatives like Reagan were being attacked as being lacking in compassion. I mean, the story of removing hundreds of thousands of people from the disability rolls really was a blemish on his record in his first term. And the concerns about a conservative being fundamentally lacking in compassion, which is clearly something that, you know, from George W. Bush onwards, right, they've attempted to remedy. And Reagan's response, you might say, in the wake of the rise of the religious right, was to talk about a pain that, as I argue, conservatives would love and could love, and that is fetal pain, because this was a way of trying to argue against abortion rights by arguing that there was an experience that the fetus had, notwithstanding the fact that the neurological science, and the neurological development in fetuses does not really support this argument. But what they did was they managed to, in films like The Silent Scream and others, highlight this as an assault on the fetus, and fetal pain came to stand in for their defense of another group of people, or another, not people, but a fetus. So whereas liberals would say, you know, we stand behind people in pain and we feel that they deserve government relief, conservatives would say, we stand behind the fetus and we believe the fetus who is subjected to this painful procedure deserves our relief. And so you have this battle that unfolds between liberals and conservatives over the question of like whose pain matters. And so you might say that, you know, it's a society that, you know, where pain politics actually works. It mobilizes your constituency, it builds a following, but you can also see how it creates new battle lines between cultural conservatives and liberals in the 1980s, which are still with us today.
Indeed, and in some ways it's just extending it, right? Because the narrative that fetal pain, and like you say, you know, without the limbic system development, it's probably a fiction. Mm-hmm. But the that notion still feeds into the old timey notion that if you're feeling pain, there is in some way you're either faking it or it implies a certain moral you're some type of moral degenerate. And of course, a fetus can't be a moral degenerate because they haven't had the opportunity to sin yet. And so
right.
it feeds into that line there.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is that the cultural politics of whose pain matters breaks along political lines also when Oregon passes its Death with Dignity Act, because you know what physicians will tell you and who know is that at the end of life, you know, pain relief, as in like morphine used at the end of life, reduces respiration and blood pressure and can be part of compassionate care. It's essential for compassionate care, but one of the debates that unfolds is whether it is also implicated in euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. So in certain states, you have the debate that said that's compassionate care, but the religious conservatives in those states say, no, that's physician-assisted suicide, and we object to that. So it turns out that in the 90s, certainly, you might say pain at two ends of the life spectrum, fetal pain and end-of-life pain, come to occupy a central role in American cultural politics. You know, liberals pulled in one direction, conservatives in the other direction. And it shows you once again, I mean, so who's not in this discussion? It's people in chronic pain, right? They kind of fall out as the debate starts to circulate around questions of fetuses and end-of-life care. So it's once again shows you how the debate that we have about whose pain matters and what degree of relief they deserve ends up kind of mirroring our cultural and our political debates, and in some ways doing harm to the real questions, which is, you know, what should we be doing for people who are living longer, who are suffering with problems, and who deserve relief and who deserve a careful and thoughtful attention to how to relieve their concerns.
In terms of talking about chronic pain, let's talk about the rise of oxycodone, because that, you know, like I said, we interviewed a journalist who had done this story, and it took place in Florida, which, according to him, was at the time in the 2008 or so, Florida was, as a state, prescribing something like 10 times more of OxyContin and RoxyContin, I think it was, maybe mispronouncing the second one, 10 times more than the rest of the country combined.
Right.
And that's why there was so much sort of OxyContin drug dealing emanating out of Florida. They were sending it around the country because it was obviously far cheaper in Florida, and that's how people were making their money. He suggested that this would be you could deal with this quite easily, and in fact, I guess one of the drug makers was fined $34 million at the time for having sort of produced more than it's even possible to imagine that people would be legitimately taking. Right. And you could deal with this by having a registry. But then I had listeners who would who called in or wrote back and said, yeah, you know, that's why my sister or brother or father can't get enough pain relief is
right.
Because of these registries.
Yeah, so, you know, OxyContin is a very, you know, complicated story, precisely as you described, because in some ways, you know, we have two problems in pain that are reflected by OxyContin. We have the problem of over-medication, and we have the problem of under-medication. And the two things are kind of, you know, two edges of the coin. That is to say, we have a system that's where we have more direct consumer advertising. We have the greater influence of pharmaceutical industries. And we have the pharmaceutical industry speaking to and promising relief without costs and making that available. And we have, to some extent, a pro-market way of thinking about the regulation of the drug industry as well, which comes out of the Reagan administration and continues through the Bush and Clinton years as well, that says, you know, the more drugs on the market, the better, and the more direct access that people have about those drugs, the better. And in some ways, what I do in the last chapter of my book is I show you how a wave of OxyContin is just the latest in a wave of market-oriented pain medicines that promise a great deal. They experience booms in the market, and then they experience tragic busts as we discover the downsides. In some ways, OxyContin is part of the conservative vision of how the market should work. You throw a market product out there, and you let the product, you know, build. But the problem is, as the skepticism about these drug products emerge, and there are people who are really in need of relief who find themselves subject to skepticism and difficulties in accessing the medicine because of those who have overuse. So we have a problem of under-medication, and we have a problem of over-prescription. And the problem in American politics, particularly with regard to the drug industry, is we go from one extreme to the other. Mm. Either we go, you know, the market is good and the problem is lack of access, or we go, the problem is, you know, bad and we need to, the drug is bad and we need to deprive people of access. So what I do in that chapter is I show how you have to understand OxyContin as a byproduct of, you know, a lot of these drugs, Bextra, Vioxx. There's a history of the booms and the busts associated with drugs like OxyContin, and sometimes they do good and often they do ill. And as you say, the other thing you have to keep in mind is that there are certain places, Florida, large elderly population, pain medicine important,
right,
but at the same time, a kind of a breeding ground for pain mills. And it's no surprise that the other centerpiece of that last chapter is Rush Limbaugh,
right,
who in 2003 is arrested for what's called doctor shopping, which also tells you something about where pain medicine finds itself today. It used to be that when you said the leading problems in drug abuse were cocaine or marijuana or heroin. Heroin's back again as a problem. But, you know, the leading problem in illegal drug use is prescription drug use these days, which shows you a lot about where it is, how far we have come as a society, and how deep the problem is in terms of how prescription drugs find their way into the gray and the black market.
And to the extent that heroin is a problem again, it is problematic as it's a substitute, really. Essentially, it's just like it's becoming like a cheaper form of those prescription drugs.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So, lastly, let me ask you this, and this may be a little bit more difficult question for you to answer. But if our culture's perception of pain is this leading indicator, give us a sense, if you can. I mean, and I think it's almost just sort of harder to make these sort of it's certainly harder to do it in real time as opposed to in retrospect. But where are we in terms of a society when it comes to perceiving pain?
I think we are in some ways still working through the broad debate that has always been before us, which is whose pain matters and who is deserving of relief. What we can't agree on right now is the answer to that question. There are some who argue that OxyContin is a great example of people who are seeking too much relief, who don't deserve it and who are creating problems. There are others who say OxyContin is an important answer to the question of who's in pain and how we deal with chronic pain effectively. There are others who say fetal pain is the most important. And there are others who say, you know, medical marijuana is the answer. And what I end the book talking about is one of my chapters is called Divided States of Analgesia. That is to say, you know, we live in a society where the question of whose pain matters varies widely, determined by whether you live literally in a blue state or a red state. Some states are passing fetal pain regulations and laws, and other states are passing medical marijuana laws. And they both are doing it in the name of people in pain. So until – I don't think there's ever a kind of national story. I think in some ways our story will always be fragmented. And the best we can do – the reason I write history in relationship to these contemporary public policy questions is to kind of try to shine a light on the deep questions, which is, you know, what does it mean to have a compassionate society? Who are we being compassionate for? And how should we look at, you know, the claims that are made about people in pain and seeing them through the lens of politics? And the last thing my book is about is, you know, because this pain is such a difficult topic, the question about, you know, who judges pain and is really at the center of it, that, you know, the book ends up being a book about those who would judge. And I think we should spend a lot more time thinking about the politics of the judgment, the politics of medical care, the politics of the politicians who are making these claims, because I think, as I said, the people in pain have been made political footballs for too long, and ultimately I'd like careful attention paid to who people in pain are, and to have an honest discussion rather than a politicized discussion about true relief.
Keith Whalew, the book is Pain, A Political History. We will link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Just a very fascinating topic.
Thank you so much.